Chapter 40. Without a line of witnesses to this aspect of the discipleship of Christ, but as he has come to accept it as the normal order of things, that what was once the rule in the Christian church should be now only the exception. Orthodoxy has framed a theory of the words of Jesus to account for this strange departure of his church from them. It teaches us to believe that his example was not meant to be followed, in this respect, by all his disciples. The power of healing which was in him was a purely exceptional power. It was used as an evidence of his divine mission. It was a miraculous gift. The gift of working miracles was not bestowed upon his church at large. His original disciples, the 12 apostles, received this gift as a necessity of the critical epoch of Christianity, the founding of the church. Traces of the power lingered on, in weakening activity, until they gradually ceased, and the normal condition of the church was entered upon, in which miracles are no longer possible. We accept this, unconsciously, as the true state of things in Christianity. But it is a conception which will not bear a moment's examination. There is not the slightest suggestion upon record that Christ set any limit to this charge which he gave his disciples. On the contrary, there are not lacking hints that he looked for the possession and exercise of this power wherever his Spirit breathed in men. Even if the concluding paragraph of St. Mark's Gospel were a later appendix, it may nonetheless have been a faithful echo of words of the Master, as it certainly is a trustworthy record of the belief of the early Christians as to the thought of Jesus concerning his followers. In that interesting passage, Jesus, after his death, appeared to the 11 and formally commissioned them, again, to take up his work in the world, bidding them, "Go ye into all the world, and preach the gospel to every creature. And ye signs," he tells them, "shall follow them that believe, not the apostles only, but them that believe, without limit of time. In my name they shall cast out devils. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." The concluding discourse to the disciples, recorded in the Gospel according to St. John, affirms the same expectation on the part of Jesus, emphasizing it in his solemn way. "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do, shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do." Appendix F. Few will deny that an intelligence apart from man formed and governs the spiritual universe and man, and this intelligence is the eternal mind, and neither matter nor man created this intelligence and divine principle, nor can this principle produce aught unlike itself. All that we term sin, sickness, and death is comprised in the belief of matter. The realm of the real is spiritual, the opposite of spirit is matter, and the opposite of the real is unreal or material. Matter is an error of statement, for there is no matter. This error of premises leads to error of conclusion in every statement of matter as a basis. Nothing we can say or believe regarding matter is true, except that matter is unreal, simply a belief that has its beginning and ending. The conservative firm called matter and mind God never formed. The unerring and eternal mind destroys this imaginary co-partnership, formed only to be dissolved in a manner and at a period unknown. This co-partnership is obsolete. Plus, under the microscope of metaphysics, matter disappears. Only by understanding there are not two, matter and mind, is a logical and correct conclusion obtained by either one. Science gathers not grapes of thorns or figs of thistles. Intelligence never produced non-intelligence, such as matter. The immortal never produced mortality, good never resulted in evil. The science of mind shows conclusively that matter is a myth. Metaphysics are above physics, and drag not matter, or what is termed that, into one of its premises or conclusions. Metaphysics resolves things into thoughts, and exchanges the objects of sense for the ideas of soul. These ideas are perfectly tangible and real to consciousness, and they have this advantage: they are eternal. Mind and its thoughts comprise the whole of God, the universe, and of man. Reason and revelation coincide with this statement, and support its proof every hour, for nothing is harmonious or eternal that is not spiritual. The realization of this will bring out objects from a higher source of thought, hence more beautiful and immortal. The fact of spiritualization produces results in striking contrast to the farce of materialization. The one produces the results of chastity and purity, the other the downward tendencies and earthward gravitation of sensualism and impurity. The exalting and healing effects of metaphysics show their fountain. Nothing in pathology has exceeded the application of metaphysics. Through mind alone we have prevented disease and preserved health. In cases of chronic and acute diseases, in their severest forms, we have changed the secretions, renewed structure, and restored health, have elongated shortened limbs, relaxed rigid muscles, made cicatrized joints supple, restored carious bones to healthy conditions, renewed that which is termed the lost substance of the lungs, and restored healthy organizations, where disease was organic instead of functional. Mrs. Eddy in error, I feel almost sure, that Mrs. Eddy's inspiration works are getting out of repair. I think so, because they made some errors in a statement which she uttered through the press on the 17th of January. Not large ones, perhaps, still it is a friend's duty to straighten such things out, and get them right when he can. Therefore I will put my other duties aside for a moment and undertake this helpful service. She said as follows. In view of the circulation of certain criticisms from the pen of Mark Twain, I submit the following statement. It is a fact, well understood, that I begged the students who first gave me the endearing appellative mother not to name me thus. But, without my consent, that word spread like wildfire. I still must think the name is not applicable to me. I stand in relation to this century as a Christian discoverer, founder, and leader. I regard self-deification as blasphemous. I may be more loved, but I am less lauded, pampered, provided for, and cheered than others before me, and wherefore? Because Christian Science is not yet popular, and I refuse adulation. My visit to the Mother Church after it was built and dedicated pleased me, and the situation was satisfactory. The dear members wanted to greet me with escort and the ringing of bells, but I declined, and went alone in my carriage to the church, entered it, and knelt in thanks upon the steps of its altar. There the first splendor of the beginnings of truth fell mysteriously upon my spirit. I believe in one Christ, teach one Christ, know of but one Christ. I believe in but one incarnation, one Mother Mary, and know I am not that one, and never claim to be. It suffices me to learn the science of the scriptures relative to this subject. Christian scientists have no quarrel with Protestants, Catholics, or any other sect. They need to be understood as following the divine principle God, love, and not imagined to be unscientific worshippers of a human being. In the aforesaid article, of which I have seen only extracts, Mark Twain's wit was not wasted in certain directions. Christian science eschews divine rights in human beings. If the individual governed human consciousness, my statement of Christian science would be disproved. But to understand the spiritual idea is essential to demonstrate science, and its pure monotheism, one God, one Christ, no idolatry, no human propaganda. Jesus taught and proved that, what feeds a few feeds all. His life work subordinated the material to the spiritual, and he left this legacy of truth to mankind. His metaphysics is not the sport of philosophy, religion, or science. Rather it is the pith and finale of them all. I have not the inspiration or aspiration to be a first or second virgin-mother or duplicate, antecedent, or subsequent. What I am remains, to be proved by the good I do. We need much humility, wisdom, and love to perform the functions of foreshadowing and foretasting heaven within us. This glory is molten in the furnace of affliction. She still thinks the name of our mother not applicable to her, and she is also able to remember that it distressed her when it was conferred upon her, and that she begged to have it suppressed. Her memory is at fault here. If she will take her bylaws and refer to Section 1 of Article XXII, written with her own hand, she will find that SE has reserved that title to herself, and is so pleased with it, and so may we say jealous about it, that she threatens with excommunication any sister scientist who shall call herself by it. This is that Section 1. The title of Mother. In the year 1895, loyal Christian scientists had given to the author of their textbook, the founder of Christian Science, the individual, endearing term of mother. Therefore, if a student of Christian Science shall apply this title, either to herself or to others, except as the term for kinship according to the flesh, it shall be regarded by the Church as an indication of disrespect for their pastor emeritus, and unfitness to be a member of the Mother Church. Mrs. Eddy is herself the Mother Church, its powers and authorities are in her possession solely, and she can abolish that title whenever it may please her to do so. SE has only to command her people, wherever they may be in the earth, to use it no more, and it will never be uttered again. She is aware of this. It may be that she effaces adulation when she is not awake, but when she is awake she encourages it, and propagates it in that museum called Our Mother's Room, in her church in Boston. She could abolish that institution with a word, if she wanted to. She is aware of that. I will say a further word about the museum presently. Further down the column, her memory is unfaithful again. I believe in but one Mother Mary, and no, I am not that one, and never claimed to be. At a session of the National Christian Science Association, held in the city of New York on the 27th of May, 1890, the secretary was instructed to send to Our Mother greetings and words of affection from her assembled children. Her telegraphic response was read to the association at next day's meeting. All hail! He hath filled the hungry with good things, and the sick hath he not sent empty away. Mother Mary. Which Mother Mary is this one? Are there two? If so, she is both of them, for, when she signed this telegram in this satisfied and unprotesting way, the mother title which she was going to so strenuously object to, and put from her with humility, and seize with both hands, and reserve as her sole property, and protect her monopoly of it with a stern by-law, while recognizing with diffidence that it was not applicable to her then, and today, that mother title was not yet born, and would not be offered to her until 5 years later. The date of the above other Mary is 1890. The individual, endearing title of mother was given her in 1895, according to her own testimony. See her bylaw quoted above. In his opening address to that convention of 1890, the president recognized this Mary, our Mary, and abolished all previous ones. He said, "There is but one Moses, one Jesus, and there is but one Mary." The confusions being now dispersed, we have this clarified result. Were it been a Moses at one time, and only one, there had been a Jesus at one time, and only one. There is a Mary and only one. She is not a husband, she is and is the author of science and health, and we cannot ignore her. 1. In 1890, there was but one Mother Mary. The president said so. 2. Mrs. Eddy was that one. She said so, in signing the telegram. 3. Mrs. Eddy was not that one, for she says so, in her Associated Press utterance of January 17th. 4. And has ever claimed to be at one unless the signature to the telegram is a claim. Thus it stands proven and established that she is that Mary and isn't, and thought she was, and knows she wasn't. That much is clear. She is also a mother by the election of 1895, and did not want the title, and thinks it is not applicable to her, and will excommunicate anyone that tries to take it away from her. So that is clear. I think that the only really troublesome confusion connected with these particular matters has arisen from the name Mary. Much vexation, much misunderstanding, could have been avoided if Mrs. Eddy had used some of her other names in place of that one. Other Mary was certain to stir up discussion. It would have been much better if S.E. had signed the telegram Other Baker. Then there would have been no biblical competition, and, of course, that is a thing to avoid. But it is not too late, yet. I wish to break in here with a parenthesis, and then take up this examination of Mrs. Eddy's claim of January 17th again. The history of her Other Mary telegram as told to me by one who ought to be a very good authority is curious and interesting. The telegram ostensibly quotes verse 53 from the Magnificat, but really makes some pretty formidable changes in it. This is St. Luke's version. He hath filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he hath sent empty away. This is Other Mary's telegraphed version. He hath filled the hungry with good things, and the sick hath he not sent empty away. To judge by the official report, the bursting of this bombshell in that mass convention of trained Christians created no astonishment, since it caused no remark, and the business of the convention went tranquilly on, thereafter, as if nothing had happened. Did those people detect those changes? We cannot know. I think they must have noticed them, the wording of St. Luke's verse being as familiar to all Christians as is the wording of the Beatitudes. And I think that the reason the new version provoked no surprise and no comment was that the assemblage took it for a spiritualized explanation of verse 53, newly sent down from heaven through Mrs. Eddy. For all scientists study their Bibles diligently, and they know their Magnificat. I believe that their confidence in the authenticity of Mrs. Eddy's inspirations is so limitless, and so firmly established that no change, however violent, which she might make in a Bible text could disturb their composure, or provoke from them a protest. Her improved rendition of verse 53 went into the convention's report, and appeared in a New York paper the next day. The at that time scientist whom I mentioned a minute ago, and who had not been present at the convention, saw it and marveled. Marveled and was indignant with the printer or the telegrapher, for making so careless and so dreadful an error. And greatly distressed too. For, of course, the newspaper people would fall foul of it, and be sarcastic, and make fun of it. And have a blithe time over it, and be properly thankful for the chance. It shows how innocent he was. It shows that he did not know the limitations of newspaper men in the matter of biblical knowledge. The new verse 53 raised no insurrection in the press. In fact, it was not even remarked upon. I could have told him the boys would not know there was anything the matter with it. I have been a newspaper man myself, and in those days I had my limitations like the others. The scientist hastened to Concord and told Mrs. Eddy what a disastrous mistake had been made, but he found to his bewilderment that she was tranquil about it, and was not proposing to correct it. He was not able to get her to promise to make a correction. He asked her secretary if he had heard aright when the telegram was dictated to him. The secretary said he had, and took the filed copy of it, and verified its authenticity, by comparing it with the stenographic notes. Mrs. Eddy did make the correction, 2 months later, in her official organ. It attracted no attention among the scientists, and, naturally, none elsewhere, for that periodical circulation was practically confined to disciples of the cult. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.